All right, my name is Scott Selliers. I am just about to turn 40 years old. We're in Lebanon, Tennessee. It is 2018, the last day of February, and I'm here talking to Mr. Bill Schorndorf. He's our volunteer over at the World War II Museum, the Tennessee Maneuvers Museum, and he just wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on in the museum over there. Bill, the first thing I saw you had on your notes there was the kind of just rough introduction whenever you have somebody come in and talk about what we do at the museum. How do you describe what we do over there?
Well, the museum started out as a carryover from the 50th anniversary of the Tennessee Maneuvers. Started out with a lot of items collected and was just a display, then it blossomed into a small museum. The 50th anniversary maneuvers were presented by Colonel Jim Henderson, United States Air Force retired. We moved into our present location about 1995. We started out as basically walk in, look around, walk out, and nobody was really getting any feeling about what went on in Tennessee and what went on in World War II. So we started trying now to teach about Tennessee, and we try to teach about World War II. Middle Tennessee in World War II hosted 7 major maneuvers, involved 850,000 troops in 3.8 million acres in 22 counties. Quite an accomplishment. Tennessee was 12th in the number of volunteers and draftees out of the 48 states in World War II. Tennessee was 27th in war production in World War II. Tennessee lost 5,731 Tennesseans in World War II. That's an amazing number for a state with the population we had at the time. Tennessee also raised $96 million in war bonds in 1942. Considering what people were making in those days and Tennessee being an agricultural state, that is a phenomenal number. Tennessee was also home to 11 POW camps in World War II with 24,000 enemy POWs living in Tennessee. We're trying to teach about the U.S. involvement in World War II. There were over 16 million U.S. veterans in World War II. We had a little over 1 million veterans killed or wounded in World War II, and American losses in World War II averaged 220 a day during the entire war. That is phenomenal. 356,000 women veterans, with an estimated 500,000 killed in sundry accidents and about a half dozen killed in World War II in action in Europe. There were 19.2 million women in war industry in World War II. There were 5 million women volunteers. They monitored prices in stores to guard against price gouging. Drivers, aircraft spotters, they worked in hospitals, daycare centers to relieve mothers to work in war industry. America in World War II was home to 20 million victory gardens. And in 1944, they produced 8 million tons of food and 4.2 billion cans and jars of preserves. Phenomenal numbers. America collected during World War II 22 million tons of scrap metal for the war industry. War production in the United States in World War II, the numbers are absolutely astounding. 102,000 tanks and self-propelled guns, 10,000 of which were lost in combat. 2.4 million vehicles, over 300,000 aircraft, almost 10,000 ships, 66,000 landing craft. All of this was done in 46 months. On display at the museum, we have German helmet, German flag, German bayonet, German dagger, American uniforms, photos, equipment, coins, paper money, personal mementos, posters, and a tablecloth from Hitler's Berchtesgaden home, which was liberated by a local GI. We also have easy reading books on all the above subjects. We have books about the cost of World War II, the human element, 50 to 70 million people dead in World War II. Also, a very popular oddities about World War II. Photos of a Nazi concentration camp taken by a local Tennessee veteran. Tours are available for groups, tour groups, and schools. You can learn about American history and Tennessee history. You just need to call Gwen at 615-547-6111. Thank you. Good?
Yeah, we're good, man. Let's keep talking now. Having a brief summary like that put together, and then you think about that building over there, you know, and you, how would you describe, okay, when you and I first talked, the first thing we really spoke about was how can we get a better picture on a website?
Yeah.
So when I'm talking to people about donations for this thing, they're not just seeing some white shack.
Yeah.
Do you still describe it as the white shack?
No. What I'd like to do, though, is to get a picture, with the sign, which was donated by a local company.
The sign on the front over the porch up there.
The one that I have on the tripod, it says, Tennessee Veterans World War II Museum. And the people around here have been very good about donations. I think I paid for one item. All the things that I've had donated and work done, I only had to pay one person. So, and that was a state regulation. They couldn't do it for free. So
above and beyond the things that are actually in the cases and things that the mementos and artifacts and things in the books and the oddities and the donations go above and beyond that. It goes into things like signage, supplies.
Supplies. Typing. My granddaughter does all my typing for me, and of course I give her a little gifted thing for Cracker Barrel, but all my typing is done for free.
That's another donation you're making right?
So
truly grassroots, volunteer run. This isn't something that's
I have getting huge arch grants. I'm trying to get a sign made up, but I think I have like 11 companies, about 10 companies local and one in Indiana that donated either product, time, or effort to help us out.
I'm on the executive committee here at the Grove, and I always try to do everything I can to make sure that the folks that donate that stuff get as much credit as we can give them. When all the people are here for the fair, right? I mean, through the course of the year, we little trickles here, little trickles there, little events. But obviously, the fair with 500,000-600,000 people going by us every day, we try to spread the knowledge of not only what we've got going on there, but the people that help make that possible. But I think one of the people that it's harder to recognize would be like yourself. So like you're a transplant here myself. Yep. We both moved. We're both about the same time frame, about 5 years ago, something like that, from where we're at now. So 2012, 2013, somewhere.
2013.
And I came to Fiddler's Grove because of a volunteer thing. I'm the same way as you. And I took it as very seriously. When I moved to Tennessee, it says volunteer state right on my license plate. I took that as a cue, and I tried to get involved in something.
Jim Henderson ran a little one-paragraph thing in the Lebanon Democrat. It said, volunteers needed at Tennessee Veterans World War II Museum, which is right up my alley. So I met him over at, hardware store over there? Not Lowe's, the other Home Depot.
Yep.
We talked in the car for about a half hour. Next thing you know, I had the key to the place. I had to learn a lot about Tennessee, being a native Connecticut type. But
there's just something about the unique history of World War II with Tennessee, especially like you said, the rural population and then the numbers. Yep. So it stays through the volunteer state. You a lot higher ratio of people. So when people were going off to war here, it was sons, it was daughters, and effort.
Tennessee was 12th out of 48 states in the number of people that enlisted and were drafted.
Right.
12th out of 48. That's a much higher 25%
per capita rate of people going in there.
And Tennessee, people weren't making no money in Tennessee. At $96 million they raised in war bonds in 1 year in World War II. $96 million. I mean, that's phenomenal when you think about it.
Yeah.
There was one, it was a African-American jazz club or blues club in Memphis, made enough money in 1 year to buy one B-24 bomber.
Really?
Yeah.
Was there any kind of a special ceremony or naming in it or something?
I have no idea. The only thing I could find on it was they raised enough money in this blues club in Memphis to buy a B-24 bomber. So I don't know if it's...
And it's like that. Okay, so that kind of information, and in the age that we live in now, And I always start out all the conversations we have how old I am, because then I'm hoping in 20 years maybe I'll sound different or something.
Yeah.
Down the road, people can kind of place time index, right?
Yeah.
But another important thing is, like, we're recording this conversation on a smartphone.
Yeah.
And it's no secret that everybody's got a computer in their pocket.
Yeah.
But unless you know what to look for, you don't find that kind of information.
Yeah.
So, like, that kind of little tidbit right there, that you had a jazz club, and probably at that time you're talking, you know, an African-American jazz club, somewhere kind of outside of what you would consider the mainstream or the establishment.
Yeah.
But here they did, on their own effort, enough war bonds to buy a plane.
Yeah.
And, like, you compare that to where we live now and the way that we do things now.
Yeah.
Nothing like that.
No.
Nothing like that. So, like, having something like that in a museum like this where people can see it.
And like I said, I try to do this oddities of World War II.
Right.
And it's amazing what you can learn about this. The youngest known veteran in World War II was 12 years old, Bronze Star, Purple Heart. The Navy found out he was underage, kicked him out of the Navy. As soon as he turned 18, they took him back. But 12 years old, earned a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart in World War II at 12 years old. So, I mean, Hitler's nephew was a World War II U.S. Navy veteran.
So it was everybody's involved in the same effort at the time.
So,
and that's another thing that we have different here. So, like, whenever we talk about military operations in the world now in 2018, a lot of times it seems distant from every person at any given time. So if you walk around the square here in Lebanon, you might meet somebody that has somebody in the service and their family. But for those that don't, it's hard for them on a day-to-day basis to feel that we're actively at war in places.
Yep.
Whereas at a time when World War II, the scrap drive we were just talking about, and the Victory Gardens.
Victory Gardens.
Everybody was involved.
Rationing, you know, what you could get. And, you know, sugar was the very first thing rationed in World War II. Before gas, before tires, before oil. Sugar was the number one, the very first thing rationed. How many people know that total rationing did not end till 1953, 8 years after the war?
Out of an effort to recoup what was already out?
So, or some things were still hard to come by, and, you know, countries overseas were still trying to recoup from, you know, the devastation and the human loss. And, you know, you couldn't get things, so things were still rationed in the United States till 1953, 8 years after the war ended.
Yeah, see, there's another little thing. So that, would that be something that would be kind of in the oddities section?
Well, I have a whole section on rationing in World War II. What was rationed? What was hard to get? You could not buy new automobiles. Tires were almost impossible to get. Any kind of electrical appliances were out, because everything was war industry. Radios, toothpaste. If you went to get a tube of toothpaste, you had to recycle the old toothpaste tube because it was made of aluminum in those days.
Sure.
Soft aluminum. Bobby pins, hair brushes. I mean, it just, you know, there's a list of about 100 items in there of things that were at. The one that would kill me was coffee. 1 pound of coffee every 5 weeks.
That was in one of
dealing in the black market. I'm sorry.
Well, when you were putting together one of the booklets that you have out, that you lay out, the little folio books that you can open up, one of the posters that you had in there was about a cup of Joe or something for.
Yeah, but I had those posters run over big because I put the posters with, you know, I have the book laid out, and then it's, you know, they're marked, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it's tabbed so you can open it up. And the first thing is the real easy reading. It's big type, big space, so you don't have to sit there and, you know, pore over it. You turn the page and it's got all the posters, you know, scrap collecting, Victory Gardens, women in the military.
Which a lot of times we derisively, I think, in a lot of ways, we say now, propaganda posters. And I'm using my quoting fingers here, right?
Well,
and that's a good way to catch them, that, you know, all in a category. But in a lot of ways, those were posters that were capturing the national ethos.
What was going on? Yeah, absolutely.
So with things like the Victory Garden and rationing and how they affected people here in Tennessee, out of the folks that you get that come through there, and again, obviously most people that we get that visit probably come during the fair.
Yeah.
But so it may be a little more rapid fire. You still get some time to talk to a few of them. But what out of those kind of facts, if you had to find one that just somebody you heard that I didn't know that, or that blows my mind, or really, like one thing that you could think of in those books that people see and they just never.
Well, one thing is the number of, when the young school kids come up, I ask them, why did they call it the World War? And they said, well, because it was number two. I said, I didn't ask you why it was called World War II. Why was it called the World War? And I tell them, in the North American, Central America, and South America, name at least 10 countries involved in World War II. And most of them can do is Canada and the United States. Mexico was signatory in World War II.
Sure.
Panama, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Venezuela, Peru, Argentina, Chile, Brazil. There were 16 countries in the Americas alone, you know, involved in World War II. Everybody says Russia, Germany, you know, the big four.
Sure.
China, Russia, you know. But come on, the Philippines, Australia, all your Asian countries, Burma, India, Thailand, Cambodia, French Indochina, Manchuria, which was Chinese, but the Japanese took it over. They are astonished by the number of countries that were involved in World War II, and countries you would never say. How many people know, you know, Mexico sent a P-47 squadron to fight in Europe during World War II? Nobody.
I've personally never heard
of
it.
Yeah, so. And like I say, I have teachers come in and say, I didn't know that. That's why I've got them books, and I have one whole section about every country, every country that was considered a country, and then their status during World War II.
And thinking about all of the different countries and all the different constituent people that were involved in a war like that, what Tennessee's place in that? Like, especially Lebanon and Wilson County and Middle Tennessee, I think that having the Maneuvers Museum part on the sign over the porch is an easy way to differentiate ourselves and what we have here than what other places might, because people didn't realize what a big deal something like the Maneuvers are.
Yeah.
So, you know, yes, all these other countries are doing things and all the people that they sent and everything else, but like a way to really get your brain around that is just think about one community, Lebanon, in a time, in a place, and look at what it did to us here.
25 divisions, and the numbers for the Army Air Corps, U.S. Army Air Force at time, I've got anywhere from like 6 to 9. I cannot, you know, get the numbers any finer.
Sure.
But 25 divisions trained here between June of 41 and February of 44. They started doing maneuvers here before we were actually in World War II.
Was there something special about here that made the maneuvers?
It reminded them of Northern Europe. They thought all the battles were going to be in Northern Europe, just like they were in World War II.
Okay.
Rolling hills, a lot of rivers, a lot of small towns. And they said, you know, we're going to be fighting in Northern Europe again, which we were, but we also fought in North Africa. We also fought in the tropics. We also fought in the Aleutians.
Sure.
Yeah, Italy. I mean.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, you know, when you say war to somebody, even now, we still kind of go back to this idea of like Napoleon lining his armies up and going out onto a flat field. But I guess as they needed something like the terrain here.
Yeah.
Some rocky, hilly trees, mixed pastures, rivers.
Know, there's an old saying about, you know, countries always prepare for the next war, to fight the next war, but the last war is technology. And, you know, they thought everybody was going to be in Northern Europe. But where was the first offensive taken was Guadalcanal in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. Then they landed in North Africa. Then they landed in Sicily. Then they fought their way all the way up Italy, which was, insane. And then the 7th Infantry Division, they trained in the desert of California, the Mojave Desert in Southern California for desert warfare going to North Africa. And of course, you know, that went out the window and they sent them to the Aleutians. So they went from tropical fighting to sub-zero fighting, you know, in the Aleutians.
Trying to get them ready to be.
We're going to do this. And all of a sudden the Japanese were up there. Oh, you know, instead of this way, we're going this way. So
when I hear the first time I ever heard the word maneuvers, I usually think of like this weekend thing where we're going to take some of our tanks and planes from over here, we're going to move them over there or whatever, like the actual maneuvering, right? But like something like the maneuvers that were going on here, some of the pictures that we've got there and that I've seen elsewhere here in town of all the camps and things were set up right over here at Cumberland University and all the troops. What would like the average life of your daily infantrymen that was being trained here in Middle Tennessee?
You know, there were seven major maneuvers, but within the seven major maneuvers were 59 different projects that they were trying to teach. One of the first uses of searchlights, one of the first uses of parachutists, one of the first units about mobile bridge crossing, how to put bridges together to ford all the rivers around here. There were quite a few things. And you know, within any maneuvers, you know, there's always a charge, you know, fixed bayonets and, you know, all this stuff. But there were a lot of, you know, subplots within the seven major.
Learning the technical aspects of how to use the equipment, how to work together, how to do the things they need to do to go over there and do it.
And, you know, they were all citizen soldiers, and, you know, they had probably 6 weeks of basic somewhere. But, you know, you don't make a soldier in 6 weeks. That's all that's to it. They come over here with basic how to zip up their pants and put their shirt on. But, you know, there's so many, you know, the minutiae of, you know, training and what's going on. It takes years to train somebody really effectively. So
you mentioned the minutia of how that all works, right? So the daily things that they might have used in their life, or the daily tools and the things that they encounter while they're here in the maneuvers. You know, a lot of the folks that I've talked to, anytime I mention World War II maneuvers, it usually tends to hinge around something that they heard somebody found.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, my neighbor found a shell, you know, an unexploded bombshell or something in their field. Or just recently they pulled that plane out of the ground over in Smith County.
Yeah.
So what, out of the things that we have in the museum here, is there one thing that is a minutia, something we can look at, an actual piece of something that we can tie and say?
A field phone that somebody left on a tree and they never picked it up. You know, that's an expensive piece of property, a field phone. We have helmets. We have blank ammunition. We have training bazooka rounds. We have a radio, C-ration cans. There's probably 35 items in there that, you know, were found on the farms and dairies and wherever the training went. Either 3.8 million acres, 875,000 people, you know, you're running with a full load, stuff pops out of your pocket and you forget stuff. So we have quite an exhibit of
just little odds
and ends, lost and found properties. You know?
The one
I get a kick of, I say, is a field phone. It was, you know, probably just hanging over a branch where somebody put the strap over it, and when they left it,
right, just hanging there. Somebody
it just stayed there for a couple of years before somebody found it. So, a blank ammunition, training rounds, 37 millimeter training rounds, the training bazooka rounds, helmets,
all in glass cases, all in
exhibit, all tagged for you to read.
So somebody walking around during the fair got a corn dog in one hand, you know. Cotton candy in the other, and they're looking at the stuff on the wall.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of my favorite things is exactly that, is that when people come here, you know, it's modern time, it's 2018, and they're walking around, they're on their phone, they're talking, you know, I've seen where they're taken out of time and place.
Yeah.
Like just walk into a building and it'll happen all at once. Maybe it's a smell, you know, they see an item and they're taken from where they're at now to this other place for just a minute. Yeah. And like for me as a volunteer, that's what kept me coming back.
You know, when I retired from the Marine Corps, I worked at Fort Myer, the Army base up in Arlington, Virginia for 20 years. And every time you drove by the motor pool when it was raining, you could smell the wet canvas on the trucks. And as soon as I got one whiff of that, my mind went back to 67, 68 in Vietnam, the first year in Vietnam. Just the smell of wet canvas just absolutely puts you in another time zone mentally. So like I say, every time I smell wet canvas, I always thought of Vietnam. Wet tents, wet, you know, canvas on the trucks. just a very distinct smell that you never get out of your system.
Right, so anytime you smell that wet canvas, you're taking another time.
I always thought about it every time I went by the motor pool when it rained. Damn, you know, here we go back again to 1967, 68, so.
Is there something, an item over there that whenever you see people coming in, and even though they might not have that personal experience to tie back to like you were with the canvas, but they see that, and then you see that they're consciously putting themselves in the place of another human being when they see it?
We have a display of all the Army Division patches in World War II. And one of the things, kids will come up and they'll say, my daddy was in this, or my grandfather was in this. And, you know, they can pick it out, relate to that colored shoulder patch. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, I wouldn't even think of that.
And, you know, and what I did, I researched a lot. And when I took over, there were 4 major mistakes in that case. They were wrong patches for what they said it was. And, you know, I had to pay out of pocket because I couldn't get anybody to donate the 3 patches, but I got them straightened out. You know, it's $15, it's not that much. But I point out the patches, especially with the young kids. I said, did you ever watch The Dirty Dozen with Lee Marvin? Oh, yeah. I said, see that patch right there? And the kids will say, yeah. I said, next time you see The Dirty Dozen, look what they're wearing on their shoulder. That's the same patch in The Dirty Dozen, that one there. Then, you ever see Kelly's Heroes with Clint Eastwood when they robbed the bank? Oh, yeah. I said, you see this patch right here? I said, that's, you. Next time you watch it, you see what they got on their shoulders. You get the kids interested in, you know, something like that, and, you know, it kind of gets them, so.
So they're trying to go around and find other items that maybe they can tie their experience to.
And, what was it? There was another one. I can't remember what it was. But I asked the older people, you know, you remember Tony Bennett, the singer? Oh, yeah. 63rd Infantry Division, right here. Tony Bennett was an infantryman in this unit in World War II. I said, you know what this patch is right here? No. I said, 30th Infantry Division, Tennessee National Guard, World War I and World War II. Hmm. I didn't know that. So I have a list alongside the case. And I have all 50 states, and what patch in the case belongs to the, you know.
Well, which ties back to you and me talking about being transplants here. So, like, even coming here, you can find something.
Yeah, where are you from? Missouri. I said, okay, we go here, Missouri. And it says, you know, what division? I said, this patch is the Missouri National Guard, which was called up and fought in World War II. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, when you tend to show them that, they say, wow, you know, I learned something about my state.
Right, sending 11 in Tennessee, walking into a museum and learning something about their own home.
Yeah, and learn something about, I'm from Idaho. Well, this is the patch for the Idaho National Guard that served in World War II. Wow. And I've had people come up and say, I know exactly which division patch is mine. Right there. I said, well, how'd you know? And he said, well, I'm a reserve in that unit, so I know what it is. So.
I'd come and gone to the museum a couple of different times, I think probably before we actually met.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I like history, so yeah, and I'm interested
here.
In it, so I some things probably grab my attention and I just kind of check it out real quick and on my way running to go do something else. But you know, it really wasn't until I was sitting there and watching you talk to a stranger I didn't know, a visitor to the museum, and watching them lean in as you were talking.
Yeah.
Right, so you could tell they were engaged.
Yeah.
They were really paying attention and watching. Is there something about the volunteer experience of being here at Fiddler's Grove and being able to talk to people about history and the things that involved their own past? What is it? What makes you keep coming back up here? What is it about that?
Well, I enjoyed meeting people, for one thing. I was in public service for years. I worked at 28 years with the post office as a window clerk. So I talk to people every day. I'm not afraid to, you know, mumble under my breath. I talk to people. I'm fairly, you know, good in English. Yeah,
right.
I don't like to use slang. And for 10 years, I was a volunteer at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And I was so good at that. I was the unofficial trainer of all new volunteers. They said, you go with Bill down at the wall, he'll teach you how to be a volunteer at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Wow. So you're skilled in the volunteer arts.
Yeah, in the volunteer arts. I enjoy doing it. the pay is great for volunteers. So. And I have had people ask me how much they paid volunteers. So.
I've noticed a lot of times, especially, so again, when I was talking about the volunteer state, when we moved here, we kind of took that as a challenge, right? We're going to get involved in things, volunteer. And when I'm saying we, I mean my wife and I and my kids. Yeah. And we all try to have something that we do above and beyond just work, school, you know, dishes and being home or whatever. Like, try to have that other thing that we do. What do you think a person that doesn't actively get out and volunteer with something like that, what kind of things are they missing in their life?
I think meeting, before I started as a volunteer at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, I just used to sit on the bench and watch the people go by. And finally, one day, this lady came up to me. She said, I see you here every day. She says, if you're going to be here, you're going to volunteer. So she throws a hat at me, and volunteer sheet, sign your name to it. But it's just amazing, some of the people you meet. I've met guys that I had not seen in 50 years. I met them at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. They come down to see the wall, and it's just amazing to renew old friendships, talk to people you never met before, talk to people from foreign countries that you've been to. I spent 11 years overseas in probably 8 or 9 different foreign countries, and it's just amazing to talk to these people. And yeah, you're trying to teach the kids instead of, sitting on my phone all day, learn something about your state, about your country, about what your great grandfather did. So, and you talk to the kids and they say, yeah, my grandfather was in, and I said, that's the division he was in, or this is the type of airplane he flew. And the kids are just, wow, they get a kick out of learning something about their family, about their state, about their country. So,
and it's real. It's right in front of them.
It's not
a Wikipedia page. It's an actual thing staring them in the face.
And say, what outfit was he? My grandfather was in. A lot of the kids know. And I say, right there, this is the patch your grandfather. Yeah, that's what's on his uniform. So, they get a kick that what their grandfather did or where their grandfather was. What this unit did. So. It's just very rewarding, and I enjoy it,
I wish we could. I wish there was a way to show people that things like museums, things like memorials, things that are typically staffed by volunteers for the most part because of the way funding works and those kind of things. We're not immune to that here. We receive grants and things from great companies and organizations. Yep. But for the most part, we have to run on volunteer work. But there's something unique about the fact that you can go somewhere like our museum here and meet somebody like you who's passionate about what you're talking about, and you're here because you honestly enjoy it.
Yep.
A lot of times your day-to-day interactions, you're dealing with somebody that's paid to be there. You know, you're dealing with somebody that maybe would rather be somewhere else in their head,
When my mother retired, the first thing she did, she was a volunteer for the March of Dimes. She was a volunteer at the hospital. She was a volunteer at the church. And she volunteered at the old people's home, reading to them, writing letters for them, talking to them, bringing them outside in the sun. And she came home, she was just happy as a lark that, she did something for somebody else. And she says, I get a kick out of doing it. She said, I enjoy it. I enjoy talking to the old timers. She writes letters for them. She reads out the Bible for them. She just enjoyed it. So I guess I got it from my mother, but I just enjoyed doing it. So.
Well, we need a big debt of gratitude to your mother for teaching you that, and to the lady that got you volunteering at the Veterans
Museum. There was a story right there. That lady, I'll tell you, she was a pistol.
And I didn't know that he'd ran an ad over here from the museum in the newspaper, and that's how he roped you in.
First thing I did when we got here, I subscribed to the paper, because you can't go every day without reading paper, even if it is just local news.
I got you.
And there was I read the one ads and the things, and there was a little, about one paragraph thing, and it says, wanted volunteers to work at the Maneuvers Museum at Fiddler's Grove. I had no idea where Fiddler's Grove is, and I live only 10 minutes from here, but I just gotten here. So I called him up, and he said, do you know where
Home Depot
is? Yeah. I said, yeah. He said, I got to go over there shopping today. He says, I drive a black SUV. I'll be parked. So I pulled up and I said, you Jim Henderson? He said, yeah, get in. So we talked about about half hour, and he said, do you know where the museum is? I said, no, but I can find it, I'm sure. So we went over, he opened it up, and
there was,
yeah,
huh?
Boy, I said, you know, I've, in the first year, you know, kids asking me about this and that, and I'm, duh, you know, what the hell do I know about Tennessee? I'm from Connecticut. So I said, yeah, the next year, well, this will not happen. So as soon as the fair was over, archives here in town, yeah, the computer, that book by, in the company of soldiers, mm-hmm, Tennessee War Museum downtown. I mean, I crammed all winter long, and I made the first book in there, Tennessee in World War II. You know, what Tennessee did, why they had the maneuvers here, the numbers, all this stuff. The second year I did World War II. Last year I did, which you helped me with the posters.
Yep.
I did women in World War II, rationing, Victory Garden, scrap drives. Yeah, you know, like I say, it's phenomenal when you get into this, and I've called people up. I'll tell you who was very instrumental was American Scrap Institute in Washington, D.C. I talked to the guy, and he said, hell, he said, I'll send you whatever you want. He sent me a wad of stuff like this. And he said, where are you? And I said, Lebanon, Tennessee. And he said, you're not going to believe this. He said, my father and I were driving to California, and we broke down in Lebanon, Tennessee, and spent 2 days there getting the car fixed. He said, I'll have the stuff in the mail to you tomorrow. So
there it is, right?
About 3-4 days later, I get a big priority package with at least that much reading in there.
Right, like an inch thick?
Yeah, so, you know, I condensed a lot of it, you know, the interesting facts about, you know, how they did things, what, you know, the numbers. And, you know, well, you see it in the movies, you know, about, you know, the bombs were made with American scrap, but America was selling 8.5 million tons of scrap metal to Japan every year until the war started.
Mm-hmm.
It's good money in it. 8.5 million tons. You're not talking about, well, you know, somebody's trash in their backyard.
Unfortunately for them, that still made it over there.
Just yeah, yeah, and they unfortunately probably made it over, and we got it back in spades. But, you know, it's a lot of these little oddities. You know, but you know, one of the things I have, one of the items I have in the book is the not-so-neutral neutrals. Now, Sweden was a avowed neutral. Mm. They dealt with the Germans. They dealt with the Allies. They let German troops transit Sweden in trains to go to Norway or to Finland to fight the Russians in Finland.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a neutral doesn't let one army through and not the other one. Spain was an avowed neutral, yet they sent, there was something like 58,000 Spaniards fought in the Division Azul, the Blue Division. Franco said 58,000 volunteers to fight in Russia for the Germans. That's not very neutral.
Yeah, no.
So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, but there was two or three things about, you know, the not so neutral neutrals. So, but you sent 58,000 troops to, you know, to fight for the Germans. You're not a very neutral person. I say you let German army transit your country. That's not neutral. So.
I always try to think of, when you speak of neutral, I was just trying to think of somebody kind of sitting back and watching the war effort.
Yeah,
if not personally involved.
Yeah,
in
I don't, yep.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just over here doing my thing, and I try to think of, like, if you were just
under the table,
right?
You know, it was another story, so.
Well, and that goes to what I was going to say. There's so many stories I've heard of just talking about here that when the maneuvers were going on and things were going on, that they, you know, they didn't have kids in the war effort. They weren't really invested in it. Yeah. Some of their, like, at the time, the ones that I'm talking to, some of their grandfathers were alive during World War I.
Yeah.
And said that they were told that was going to be the last war. They weren't getting involved in another one. They weren't sending their kids off to die. But here they are here. Everything came to them here. And now there's stories of people selling the troops cigarettes and
candy and newspapers.
Yep.
Well,
it's amazing how whenever there's a war going on, everybody's involved in it, whether they know it or not.
Like I say, my father built Corsair fighter planes in World War II. Mm-hmm. My mother worked at Bridgeport Brass Company, where they made shell casings in World War II. So, and you know, my hometown, Bridgeport, or Connecticut period, was, you know, way up there in war production. I mean, they made, Corsair fighter planes, float planes, helicopters were just coming into use at the end of the war. Submarines at Electric Boat Company in Groton, they were turning out submarines every day up there. Remington Arms Corporation, millions of rounds of ammunition. Bridgeport Brass, Singer sewing machine made gun barrels, sights, chance water aircraft with the Corsairs, Colt up in Hartford, Pratt Whitney aircraft, engines. I mean, thousands and thousands of aircraft engines in Connecticut in World War II.
And that's just small and arms. That's a small little state of Connecticut.
Yeah, imagine. Connecticut's the third smallest country, but their war production was just phenomenal.
Anything here in Tennessee you can think of that was being manufactured close by that was going to the war effort?
Yeah. Did you know they built ships in Nashville?
No.
They built sub chasers, minesweepers. They built them, and the company is still in business today. Nashville Bridge and Iron is still in business today. But they built ships in World War II. They sailed them down the Cumberland to the Mississippi, down to New Orleans, outfitted them, turned them over to the Navy. So, it's a whole slew of, every state went over to just about 100% war industry.
Right, national effort. Yeah.
Lebanon Mills was making blankets.
The wool blankets, that's what I was...
Uniforms. Yep. And a lot of people don't know what an Army Navy E was during World War II, but if a company was exceeding production and the product was really good, they didn't have to worry about it. They were making a great product and they were exceeding production quotas, they got a pennant which had an E on it, and it said Army Navy E, E for excellence. Lebanon Woolen Mills had a Army Navy E for excellence in what they were doing when World War II.
Huh?
One of the first Army Navy E's awarded in World War II, you'll never guess what company it was given to.
Hmm.
Now, people say General Electric, Ford, GE, blah, blah, blah.
The obvious big dogs.
Chef Boyardee was one of the first Army Navy E's for canned food to the military.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't called Chef Boyardee. It was just canned something.
Right.
But and people say, really? I said, yeah. So.
Well, if you're going to get somebody involved, you got to talk to them about their Chef Boyardee, right?
Yeah. And, on rationing, when meat was rationed, and the government said, macaroni and cheese is a substitute for meat. In 1943, 83 million boxes of macaroni and cheese were sold in the United States. 83 million boxes. Yeah. I mean, it's all these little, odd things. You wouldn't think bobby pins would be hard to get, but bobby pins were metal.
Metal, yeah.
So they, coffee. Now, if coffee was 1 pound every 5 weeks, I'd be in the black market because I like my coffee. I'm sorry.
I'm in the same boat.
Yeah, so.
So but, if there was a, where, one thing that you could say to somebody, if they're going to visit Lebanon, and they were only going to be here, like the fellow that was broke down for 2 days that you met.
Yeah.
And you only had a little limited time to be here. If there's going to be something in the World War II Maneuvers Museum over here that you think that they would be worth their time, what would be the thing that you would point at?
Just the fact that, the guy that liberated the tablecloth from Hitler's home in Berchtesgaden. And they have a picture of him with the tablecloth under his arm, Berchtesgaden in ruins in back of him, and him with a bottle of wine in his hand. And I don't know if it's true, but I like to embellish the story a bit. And say the tablecloth made it back, but the wine didn't. And we have a key from the projection room. And there was he had a theater in Berchtesgaden. We have the key to the projection room. It's labeled in there. We have a Hitler Youth dagger, which an SA pennant. People say, what's an SA pennant? They don't know what the SA was. People are forgetting about the war. The Sturmabteilung, the brown shirts that started Hitler's rise to power.
Yep.
So we have one of them. So
the whole span of the war right here in Lebanon, Tennessee.
Yeah, and I wrote a letter. In fact, Gwen typed it for me about 2 weeks ago. I sent it out to Navy Recruiting Command in Memphis asking for some pictures. I have no pictures of ships or planes. Mm. And I told the guy who we are, I would say what we are at the museum, a little bit about me, retired Marine and board ship in 59, 60, 61, Vietnam service overseas. And I asked him for 9 pictures. And I said, the 9 pictures are the Arizona, which started the beginning of the war, Missouri, where they signed the surrender. And the others are Yorktown, the Battle of Coral Sea, and the Battle of Midway, the big victory of the U.S. USS Tang, 33 enemy ships sunk. USS England, 6 Japanese subs in 12 days they sunk, which nobody has ever came close to breaking. Indianapolis brought the bomb material and the catastrophe when it was sunk and all those. So I told the guy, these are all hero ships. And I said,